I have never made these 500 PowerPoint slides available to anybody. So this is very, very special for you. I want you to reflect on some of the 13 hours that we have spent together here in trying to understand better that health is the very foundation of a good life. You say, well, health is not everything, but health without life without health is nothing. So health is the foundation for the good life that God wants us to have. And I've tried to do my best to help you to understand what a gracious, loving Creator God we have who planned it all out for us, but that the adversary has come into the play and has produced his foods. And we have fallen into the trap of these foods for various reasons. But he's calling us into the best life possible, and that is to follow a life that God has designed for us. This is my last presentation. I want to focus this morning on the Adventist health heritage, which I consider to be a sacred trust. And I'd like you to go to the 2 Chronicles chapter 20. Here you see the story of Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat was the king of Judah, a man who enthusiastically served the Lord, and Jehoshaphat the king is badly shaken. He only has a small, motley army. And then the word reaches him that a multinational, huge army is moving towards Jerusalem, and he knows he is a goner. With his back against the wall, without any help in sight, this king prays a heart-rending prayer, and the Lord answers through one of the priests in verse 15 and 17. Listen to me. Listen to me, O people, all you people of Judah and Jerusalem, and you, O King Jehoshaphat. He explained, the Lord says, don't be afraid. Don't be paralyzed by this mighty army, for the battle is not yours, but God's. And then verse 17. But listen, you do not need to fight. Take your places, stand quietly, and see the incredible rescue operation God will perform for you. O people of Judah and Jerusalem, don't be afraid or discouraged. Go out there tomorrow, for the Lord is with you. And then the next morning, as this small little army that the king has moves into position, the king stops them and calls them to attention. Verse 20. Listen to me. O people of Judah and Jerusalem, believe in the Lord your God and you will succeed. Believe and remain steadfast to his prophets and you shall prosper. Believe and remain steadfast to his prophets and you will prosper. And what happens at the end of the day? The mighty multinational army is totally destroyed. Not a single person, not a single soldier of the enemy escapes without any losses to the king's motley army. What God has wrought. The battle is God's. We have a very trustworthy God. He's reliable. He lives up to his word as we trust him. I think you have picked up the idea during this week that there's a major a movement, an awakening taking place in this country and around the world. It is called intelligent self-care for the chronic diseases. One of the leaders of this movement is Rick Warren. Rick Warren is a pastor of a mega church with 30,000 members in Southern California. He is the man that had the prayer of ordination for President Obama some years back. He is the man that has written the purpose-driven books, the purpose-driven church, the purpose-driven people, and so on and so forth. This man has written books that have been published in 20, 30, 40 million numbers in copies. And this man became very concerned about his church members. He became concerned because he noticed that not only the church members, but himself, he himself, had gained weight over time. And so he began to look in the book of Daniel for some a prescription for better health. And he found the first chapter of Daniel that you all know. Daniel lived at the court of Nebuchadnezzar, and instead of following the king's royal diet, he chose to follow a very simple diet of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and legumes, and lots of water to drink. The Bible talks about pulses and water. And he began to use this plan in his own life. He lost 60-some pounds. And then he said, we need to do something for our church members. And 14,000 people signed up for his Daniel Plan program. And these people lost 250,000 pounds in 1 year. And the pastor said, now we have much more room in our church. We can do evangelism to bring new people in. But more than that, he said, my goal is to make this Daniel Plan available to 1 billion people around the world. And I thought to myself, Rick Warren, you're just a Johnny come lately, because the Adventists have had this message for 150 some years. But what have we done with that message? That's the question I want to raise this morning. We, as a church, were entrusted with this sacred message of health through divinely appointed visions more than 150 years ago. We were at the very vanguard. We were the leaders. We were at the forefront of such an approach so powerfully demonstrated in Battle Creek at the Battle Creek Sanitarium years ago. My question this morning is this: will we as a church again pick up the mantle and lead? Or have we been left behind too long already with the health message? We have heard it, but we have not done it. And so what I want to do this morning, I want to help you to have a new appreciation for the richness of our health message, our health heritage, and to value again the incomprehensible trust given to us by a loving God, a magnificent creator. I want to take you back to the 1830s. That was a time of westward expansion, because then America was the East Coast. And when you moved westward, you came to Michigan. That was the Wild West in those days. And there was a man by the name of John Preston Kellogg. He lived in Massachusetts, and he heard the clarion call to move west to explore new territory. And he took his wife, two children, and his earth belongings, put it into a covered wagon pulled by two horses, and he was on his way to the Wild West. He settled in a town called Flint, where he bought 400 acres of land and began to homestead. Now, tragically, the Kelloggs were sick most of the time, and the medical offerings at that time were absolutely pathetic, if not downright dangerous. Mrs. Kellogg had tuberculosis, and she was treated with bloodletting. She was treated with purging. And her children were purged and vomited and bled and blistered, and that was considered to be good medicine in those days. When her tuberculosis got the best of her and she died, she left behind a widower, 5 children, and a new homestead. Well, if you were Kellogg, a widower, 5 children, and 400 acres to take care of, what would you do? What would you do? You would look for a wife, wouldn't you? That's exactly what he did. He looked for a wife, and he found a very capable lady by the name of Anne Stanley. She was an outstanding woman, and she encouraged him to move from Flint later on to Battle Creek. And it was here that their 2-year-old daughter, Emma, got very sick. The doctor diagnosed the sickness as having worms. He prescribed a very powerful drug which caused epilepsy, and little Emma died within 2 days. Needless to say that the Kelloggs were very bitter about American medicine and what it had done for them, if anything. What was American medicine like in those days? American medicine was dominated by 2 towering medical giants. One was Dr. Tully and one was Dr. Gallop. These were the 2 schools of thought at that time. Dr. Tully believed in powerful drugs. He prescribed heroin and opium and strychnine, powerful drugs, because these doctors believed that if you challenge the body with these powerful drugs, the body will then regroup and develop its own resources and fight the original disease. Well, let me tell you, they lost many, many people. Every second person died that was treated by these doctors. And then you had Dr. Gallop. He didn't believe, like Dr. Golly, in powerful drugs. He believed in bloodletting. And his idea was, the reason why people have infections, the reason why people have fever, is because they have too much blood. So what do? If you have too much blood, put the leeches on to suck the blood out, or make some incisions and drain the blood from the body. And they were very successful because the fevers always dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped. They dropped so low that they never had fever ever again in their lives because these people died. And so to die, death, was a frequent complication in the treatment of diseases by these so-called doctors. You have to understand that medical education in those days was in its infancy. Anybody could become a physician. All you had to do is complete a 6-month course, and you could put your sheepskin up, and you could practice medicine. Literally, practice medicine. Now, if you didn't have access to these so-called doctors, then you would rely on these home health guides. These were special manuals, and they helped you to diagnose your own illness. They described all the different symptoms, so you could become your own doctor, and then they provided you also with all kinds of medications, drugs that you could use. And these pills then were really pushed pretty hard by the industry, which flourished under the maxim, a doubtful drug, a doubtful pill is better than none at all. So they would take a lot of chances in those days. And these pills were pushed by an unscientific and unscrupulous drug industry. Let me give you some ideas. Let me give you some quotes, how they promoted these drugs. Any drug, no matter how worthless or outrageously adulterated in those days, could actually be placed on the market. And any statement, no matter how fantastic, any ingredient, no matter how habit-forming and lethal, could be used without mentioning it on the label. Here are some of the quotes that were used. Or let me just for time's sake, because just, I'm realizing that I have to catch a plane, let me just skip that, but let me just give you some summary. Most drug advertisements contain testimonials from people who had since died of the disease the drug was supposed to have you cured. These drugs tasted absolutely terrible, they were horrible, they stung the throat, they gagged the patient, who was often cured after just 1 dose, simply out of fear of having to take a 2nd dose. Now, if you didn't have money for these home health guides, and the drugs that came with them, then you would probably have to rely on folk medicine. Now, folk medicine, this was sort of common in the society then. If you had earaches, they recommended take a cigar, smoke a cigar, and blow the smoke into the infected ear. That was supposed to be the cure. If you had arthritis, it was recommended that you get yourself a cat. This is what people did. And they placed the cat at the foot end of the bed, and then you were supposed to, during the sleep, you were supposed to touch the cat with your feet, and it was believed that the arthritis would leave your body and enter the body of the cat. Better for you, worse for the cat. Fresh air, yeah, you didn't want to be out in fresh air. If you're a patient and you had a small clinic, your physician would make the rounds every night to make sure that every window was closed, because it was believed that fresh air was dangerous to the health of a patient. How about bathing? Oh, you needed to have a prescription for taking a bath. They didn't recommend more than one bath a week with doctor's prescription only, because it was believed that bathing was dangerous to your health. They had not yet discovered germs, and you know, we were in the very infancy of understanding disease. So to summarize a little bit more, it was a tragic situation what folk medicine represented. Now, I could also make maybe a comment on the fashion of the day. The fashion of the day was, if you were a high society woman and you wanted to be in, you wanted to have the proper shape, you wanted to have what they call a wasp waist. A wasp waist was ideally the size of a waist where your husband could put his hand around your waist and the fingers would touch. Now, can you imagine? There were not very many men that had hands large enough to accomplish that. And so, but these women wanted to have those wasp waists, and so they had to invent the corset. So these corsets, oftentimes, were pulled so tight that it bisected the liver, and people died from this. And then on top of this, you would have these long hoop skirts. They dragged the floor. They were about 60 to 80 pounds heavy. So you have this very tiny waist, and then you have these long, heavy dresses that would go down to the floor. And then you had men chewing tobacco and spitting it out on the floor. And there was no hygiene in those days. In those days, you had horses everywhere, and they left their calling cards behind. You know what I'm talking about. And so then these women with the long hoop skirts would come around, distribute all these germs. No wonder that every fifth baby died in those days from infectious diseases. Now you know why a person by the name of Ellen G. White talked about dress reform. These were the things that we used to do in those days. So let me just summarize then what it was like. The 1850s were an incredible time to be alive. Interesting fashions, interesting medical concepts, interesting hygiene, and this was the very time into which the great spiritual awakening struck, which led to the establishment of many denominations. One denomination in particular was becoming characterized by a very unique lifestyle and a philosophy of healthful living. This group was motivated by the belief that the human body was a temple of God, which was an unusual idea in those days. In those days, we believed that the body was divided into a soul and a body, and the soul was the ultimate important aspect of the human body. And it was believed that the goal was to have the soul get out of the body and to have eternal life. Therefore, you didn't want to take care of the body because it became a prison to hold the soul in a place that you didn't want it to be. And so in those days, there were no hospitals. There was no medical care that was really interested in taking care of the body, really, except for this group of people that emerged in the 1850s and 60s that believed that God created soul, mind, and body as one unit, and to take care of the body as a temple of God was the right thing to do. They stood out as a sore thumb in the philosophical time of that we lived there. And so they believed that it was okay to take care of the human body. It was perfectly okay, as a matter of fact. And so they began to open up a special health center. They began to think seriously of what could be done to take care of the human body. And so in 1863, the newly organized Seventh-day Adventist denomination was convinced that it might be best to have its own medical institution to effectively demonstrate the benefits of healthful living. An unusual development for the times. And these Adventists were persuaded by a remarkable Battle Creek housewife named Ellen G. White. She was a remarkable woman with only a grade 3 education, and yet she went on to write more serious books published in more languages with a wider distribution than any other woman in the world, period. This humble Battle Creek housewife wrote, for instance, in the fields of nutrition and dietetics, and in the areas that she had no real background, she had no authority to write or training. Nevertheless, this woman laid the nutritional foundation for the Adventist lifestyle. Listen to what she said in 1901. She said, "The whys and wherefores I really don't know, but I give you the instruction it was given to me." And can you believe it? This issue that I'm referring to right now was dealing with the amount of salt that we should eat. And the contemporaries, the health reformers of the day, were very divided on the issues. Some of the reformers at that time said, we should have more salt. We need much more salt than we have currently. And others said, we shouldn't have any salt. And she said, we should have some salt. How did she know which concept to pick? If it wasn't by a direct intervention by the Spirit of God. And you know, it took till 1977 when the U.S. government dietary guidelines recommended to Americans to cut their high salt intake and to use salt at least only half of the amount. It just sounds like Ellen G. White, have some salt, not so much, but on the other hand, don't have any salt. No, that was not the idea to embrace either. Have some salt. It took till 1977 for scientific bodies, the U.S. government, to make those recommendations to people, a recommendation that she had made in 1901. She recommended we should eat more coarse food. What is coarse food? What does it mean, coarse? It's the opposite of refined. So she said we should eat more coarse food. We should eat more foods as grown high in fiber. She recommended to eat more fruits and vegetables, whole grains and legumes with some nuts and seeds. This is all the kind of things that are now recommended by the scientific community everywhere. You go to the Heart Association, you go to the Cancer Society, you go to the Diabetes Association. Everybody says we have to eat more fruits and vegetables. We recommend, as a matter of fact, many organizations now recommend we should aim for 9 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. We used to recommend 5, but now we have gone up to 9, ideally 9 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. How did she know these things with a grade 3 education in her day? How did she know that it would be wiser to eat less meat or no meat at all. How did she know this? And it was only 2 years ago that the World Health Organization declared that processed meat was a cause of colon cancer. They actually said, we can have a mathematical formula. The more meat you eat, the more colon cancer you will have. It is just like the more you smoke, the more lung cancer you will have. These are cause and effect relationships. And people that have heard this message for years in the Adventist church, we still say, well, I enjoy my meat. I don't care. So be prepared for those consequences. But then we all of a sudden pray, Lord, save me. Well, Lord is giving us exactly what we need to do. Are we trying to challenge God? The cause and effect relationships. You smoke, every second person will develop lung cancer. You eat meat, and people will develop colon cancer. The more meat, the more colon cancer. And the other relationships too. With breast cancer, some of these relationships are becoming more and more clear to us. She talked about the time will come when we shouldn't have dairy products anymore, cheese. Well, we're still saying, well, the time hasn't come yet. Well, when is the time going to be here? We're pushing it out all the time so that we can take care of our perverted appetites. Is that right? Listen, folks. She said, those who can overcome an appetite will be able to overcome every other temptation and sin. How we eat, how we make our choices in the area of food is becoming a schooling program for us to become stronger in Him, to empower us to live the best, the holy life. Is that right? For people that are waiting for the Lord to come. She talked about tobacco. This is years and years ago. If you talked about tobacco as being a malignant poison, just think about those very select words for a woman that only had a grade 3 education. He talked about it's a malignant poison. She wrote that in 1864, tobacco is a poison of the most deceitful and malignant kind. End of quotes. Did you know that it took 102 years for the Surgeon General of America to catch up with her in pronouncing that there was a relationship between smoking and lung cancer? How did she know this in 1864 when she wrote, tobacco is a malignant poison of the most deceitful kind? Amazing. She talked about electricity in the human body, and yet we had no concept at that time that every cell in the body has a small voltage that we can use in the principle of electrocardiography. How did she know? She talked about poisonous drugs that would cause birth defects. This was clearly before the time of the thalidomide scandal in Germany, where pregnant women were prescribed oftentimes this thalidomide drug during pregnancy, and they would then give birth to flipper children, children that were born without legs and without hands and arms. Flipper children, because women during pregnancy were taking drugs. And she talked about, be careful about poisonous drugs that can cause birth defects. How did she know? She talked about alcohol. She wrote that alcohol damages the brain permanently. And she advised mothers not to use alcohol during pregnancy because it could lead to the fetal alcoholism syndrome that was only discovered in 1972. Where they noticed that women who had used alcohol during pregnancy would oftentimes give birth to deformed children, facially deformed with smaller brains. How did she know this when she wrote these things? In the meantime, in 1866, a short man, but a giant nevertheless, by the name of J.N. Loughborough, was on his way to raise funds for this new health center that the Adventist Church, the new denomination, wanted to build. Because remember, they believed in taking care of the body was okay. It was the right thing to do. And so he began to raise money for developing this health center, and he was not very successful. As a matter of fact, nobody gave him any money. It was very difficult to raise any money in those days until he came to the broom factory of John Preston Kellogg. Do you remember him? John Preston Kellogg was a man that had suffered from the hands of what we then call medicine. His wife had died, children had died, and he now said, I'm going to help you. I believe we need to have a new healthcare system. We need to do something different. And he wrote out a check for $50,000 equivalent in our currency today. And Loughborough grew several inches all at once, and he dashed across the street to the house of Alan and James White, and he said, $50,000 equivalent in our currency today. Can you help us? And they matched it. Now, the Whites didn't have much money. I mean, if you have seen the furniture that they used in those days, there were no matching chairs, nothing like this. And yet, these people are totally committed to the Adventist concept of establishing a new health care center. And they said, somehow the money will come in. I'm writing books. Maybe there's some royalties coming in. They believed in God. God will take care of us. They lived a very frugal life, and they wrote a check for equivalent to $50,000 today. And Kellogg got even taller. And with those monies in place, in September 5, 1866, the Western Health Reform Institute opened up to demonstrate that God wanted to have healthy people. Now, it was a successful operation and very quickly grew, and there was a need for trained personnel. And about 10 years later, after the opening of the Western Health Reform Institute, a young 24-year-old well-trained physician who had been sponsored by the White family took over as medical director of this institute and renamed it immediately what's the name? The Battle Creek Sanitarium. He coined a new word, sanitarium, meaning here is where we teach people how to live. The Battle Creek Sanitarium became one of the largest institutions in the area of health care in the world. Do you remember that young man, John Harvey Kellogg? You heard of him? He was the 10th child of John Preston Kellogg, the man who wrote the original check for $50,000 equivalent and helped the establishment of the Health Reform Institute there. So John Harvey Kellogg now began to take over. He was a very well-trained physician. He emerged later on as perhaps one of the foremost physicians in America. The Mayo brothers would sit at his feet and learn surgery from him. Kellogg would be in Vienna and study surgery at some of the finest surgeons and professors in the world then. And he brought these skills back home. He was a very, very gifted man. Now, you have to understand that in those days, when you would go to a hospital, you had a 50-50 chance of coming out alive. Dr. Kellogg served 20,000 patients in 10 years, and 10,000 of these should have died, except in his case, only 10 people died per year. So it was 100 people roughly in 10 years instead of 10,000. And this is what catapulted the image of Battle Creek Sanitarium into the world sphere as the most outstanding treatment center for the disease that we had in those days. It became the medical mecca in the world. It had the lowest mortality that anybody had ever seen. This is now the 1880s, the 1890s, the 1900s. At its height in 1906, the The Battle Creek Sanitarium served 7,000 patients. They had a staff of 1,800 people, and the sanitarium became the in-place for the wealthy and the prominent. Let me tell you a few things here about what happened there. You know, John Harvey Kellogg was the one that invented the dancing with for purpose. It wasn't some of the people that we have nowadays. He already did this. When the gramophone came along, he had everybody make movements. Use your arms, use your legs, get involved in exercise. This is the place where Town and Gown met. This is where people met, like Henry Ford would be regularly there, James Buick, Harvey Firestone, and people like Andrew Carnegie and Thomas Edison and Ivan Pavlov. Remember the psychologist that had the classical conditioning with dogs? Yeah, that's him. Pavlov took the concept of the sanitarium to the Ukraine where he was from, and you can still see some of the remnant buildings there in the Ukraine where they had built sanitariums copying what was happening in Battle Creek. The Mayo brothers were there at Battle Creek. And also, you had John D. Rockefeller there. Rockefeller came to Kellogg, and he was the richest man then, probably. Rockefeller came to Dr. Kellogg and said, "I have gastric ulcers. They tell me I don't live very long. I'm losing blood because of the bleeding ulcers there. Is there anything that you can do?" And Kellogg was very self-assured. Kellogg was very self-confident. He was running all kinds of experiments all the time. And he knew that if you become a vegetarian, you have a much better outcome than if you are not. And so he turned to Rockefeller and said, "Sir, here are 20 guidelines. You follow these 20 guidelines and you live a long and happy life. But just one more, Mr. Rockefeller. Don't forget us here at Battle Creek. Be generous." Rockefeller lived to be 99 years. He was a big follower of Dr. Kellogg. When Arctic explorers went on their discovery of the North Pole, they always first stop in Battle Creek to ask Dr. Kellogg, "What is it that we should take with us as far as food supplies are concerned?" Kellogg was the man. He had unusual surgical skills. He had unusual writing skills. He would write the New Dietetics, a book of 500 pages. He developed orthopedic chairs that were more appropriate than the chairs then used. And he listened very carefully to Ellen G. White. It is believed that Kellogg at Battle Creek Sanitarium were about 10 years ahead in their practice of medicine in comparison to other physicians and clinics because he listened to Ellen G. White. When a new idea came along, medical people in those days used trial and error methods. Kellogg just asked the prophet, "Tell me, do you have some wisdom? Do you have some idea of what we should do with this new concept?" And if she had, she would tell him yes and he would do it. If she didn't, she would say, "I don't know," and he would wait. This is perhaps the reason why Battle Creek was 5 to 10 years ahead of anybody else in America at that time in when these new concepts in medicine emerged. Here he is. He himself lived 91 years of age. He was sometimes not always very well understood. I remember the story when I spent some time at the Kellogg Foundation to prepare for a speech to honor Dr. Kellogg. I remember what I read, camp meeting at Wisconsin. Kellogg was there, he was a speaker. And he noticed that cheese was everywhere on the campgrounds. And so he went to the matron of the cafeteria and he said, "I want to buy all the cheese that you have." And she said, "Well, it's fine." And he purchased all the cheese that was in the cafeteria there, and he hired two men to dig two graves. And he buried the cheese. And the very same day, the conference president bought the new portions of cheese. And you can just imagine the frustration that John Harvey Kellogg felt as a physician who was ahead of his time and who listened to the prophet who had said, be careful with cheese. You remember? So you can see, we sometimes see Kellogg only in one way, in that he kind of lost his way in his theology. Yes, that's true, but he also was oftentimes misunderstood and mistreated by the clergy of the Adventist Church. Kellogg was revered, particularly not only for his surgical skills and the huge sanitarium hospital there, but he was also revered for his famous parlor lectures. This was always a highlight of the people that came to Battle Creek. This is when Thomas Edison and Andrew Carnegie and Henry Ford and James Buick and Ivan Pavlov, they all would gather in the parlor there to listen to Dr. Kellogg. He always had a white suit on. He had this white goatee, and he was a powerful lecturer. He talked about biological living. He talked to people what they can do to help themselves. It was self-care at its very best, intelligent self-care, what we need to do for ourselves to avoid these chronic diseases that are largely self-made and culturally promoted. And to Kellogg, when it came to healthful living, nothing was more important than to emphasize the consumption of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, and some nuts and some seeds. And of course, these prominent people that came to the sanitarium, when they sometimes had 7,000 patients per year coming to Battle Creek, most of these were heavily into meat consumption. And it was at that time that they began to think of what can we do to bridge the gap. We need to move them towards a vegetarian lifestyle. And they invented these phony bolognese. They invented those transitional foods. They had their place. And they still have their place even today. But these are not necessarily health foods anymore. We know better now. God's health foods are fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, and some nuts and some seeds and plenty of water. And be careful with fats, oils, and grease. And be careful with salt and sugar. But these are the very concepts that Ellen G. White established, promoted, and passed on to Dr. Kellogg. He was a remarkable teacher. He was a best-selling author. He was a leading health advocate. He was a researcher and inventor. They say that he would drive his bicycle in a circle there while dictating to two secretaries at the same time. An enormous dynamo of a man. Because of the success at Battle Creek, but the advocacy of a holistic concept of health and lifestyle, the reputation of the Adventist Church also grew very rapidly. I mean, just think what we could do as if we as a church would really believe in a health message and promote it as we should. Everybody would come to us. Now we have the Adventist Health Study. We are talking about this at large medical conventions, and we show that people that are vegetarians, they live much longer, they have much less heart disease, they have much less diabetes, and so on. We have these things that are happening in the medical community, but we need to do it at the grassroots level where we are. We are the epistles of God. We are what the people read. Could we do better than we do? Could we make some changes in our cafeterias? Could we make some changes in our potlucks? Could we make some changes in our homes? Could we? Would God bless us if we do this? Are we doing this to get brownie points for heaven? No. We do it because we have found the love of God and we respond to Him. Do we have to do everything all at once? No. Do the best you can. The Spirit will lead us step by step. But we have to make commitments. And the Spirit gives us the strength
to stand tall. And as we stand tall, we feel better. We're more alive. We're revitalized. We're no longer falling asleep in the sermons. We're no longer worried about taking those 10, 15 drugs every day and pills every day that we have to swallow. And with that, you always have to worry about side effects. Every time you take a drug, you have to worry about a side effect, even when you take an aspirin, which sounds very innocuous. And so, what did they actually teach at Battle Creek? What did they really teach aside from practicing good medicine that was usually 5 to 10 years ahead of everybody else in America because of the concept that Dr. Kellogg followed the counsel of Ellen G. White in the area of managing disease? What they emphasized? They emphasized a very simple diet. That diet was to be planned, food strong. They recommended a diet that was whole food oriented, simply prepared. They recommended daily exercise with plenty of water to drink, and they recommended a micro vacation one day a week. Are you with me?
Yeah.
They recommended abstinence from tobacco and alcohol and caffeine and tea. They also recommended a balanced life undergirded by a faith and trust in a loving Creator God. That was Battle Creek. The results? Longer life, better life, fewer diseases, with compressed morbidity at the end. Let me tell you what that really means. Compressed morbidity. That means most Americans, when they turn 55 or thereabouts, they develop these diseases, these chronic diseases, and they progress steadily. And by the time that they're 70, 75 years of age, they have gradually died over the last 15, 20 years. We're living longer, sicker. But then you look at the Adventist people, according to the Adventist Health Study, especially the vegetarians, what they found is that these people, they develop their diseases too. They die from heart disease too. They die from cancer too. But it happens when they are during the last 2 years of their lives, and they're at 85 and 89. In the last 2 years, they have a disease, and it takes their lives, and that's it. I used to always tell people, well, people die from old age. I didn't understand that. Now we know from the Adventist Health Study, because we know these long-living people, they develop a final disease at the very end, and it compresses the disease probably in 1, 2, 3 years. It shortens the period. What do you want? Do you want to die slowly over 10, 15 years? You lose your function, your medication, and those medications don't really do much good for you. You will stay on these medications until you're dead. Because these medications do not cure you. Most of these medications don't do anything for you when it comes to these chronic diseases. Remember, I'm not talking about infectious diseases. When you have pneumonia, you better get the doctor and get the medication. Don't come to me and say, how much broccoli should I eat? No. But when it comes to chronic diseases, which absorb 86% of our medical bill in America as a nation, think of how much money we as a church spend for chronic diseases for our pastors and workers that somehow have not quite caught on yet that we need to become involved in our own health. And so, here are some of the clinical findings from some of the large Adventist health studies in North America. We have gone through those already once before. We've talked about the fact that Adventist men and women live longer. Also, they usually weigh 30 to 40 pounds less if they're vegetarians than compared to meat eaters. We talked about the idea that Adventist meat eaters have 4 times more diabetes than Adventist vegetarians. They have 4 times more high blood pressure on medication than vegetarians. And when it comes to cholesterol, they have 5 times more cholesterol medication on board than people that are pure vegetarians. Okay. It's this kind of an Adventist lifestyle. There's no becoming more and more the sample that is being used by others. Here you have Nathan Pritikin. You have Dr. William Castelli from the Framingham study. You have Dr. Dean Ornish on Newsweek. What do they recommend? They all recommend a vegan diet. Food as grown, whole foods. You have Neil Barnard in Washington, a personal friend of mine. He has written a book, Reversing Diabetes Without Drugs. And he has 60, 74% of his patients in 26 days off medications for type 2 diabetes. Here's Dr. Campbell, and we have asked you folks, look at the book, The China Study. It's a classic. It has been a bestseller for 11 years since it came out. It's a somewhat demanding text, but it's an outstanding book, China Study. Then you have the book by Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn from the Cleveland Clinic, Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease. That's much easier to read, and you have 150 pages of recipes in there. Of course, he's very, very rigid, no oil, you know. He doesn't even recommend nuts, but you know, we have a little bit of a different idea there because we have a higher authority to help us on that point. But otherwise, it's an exceptional book. And then, of course, you know, the two icons of these two books, Dr. Campbell and Dr. Esselstyn, became the featured heroes in the book Forks Over Knives. Coming out of Hollywood, it has been the best-selling documentary film for the last 5 years, ever since it came out. Still is number one. This should be shown in all of our Adventist churches. We should bring the community in. And if you don't want to bring them to the Adventist church because they may be hesitant, take them to the community hall. But you be the sponsor of the program. What does it really mean, forks over knives? It means that the forks are more important than the surgeon's knife when it comes to many of these chronic diseases. That's what that means. And then you have, of course, a former president, President Clinton, who is following an exact diet that he picked up from Dr. Ornish and from Dr. Esselstyn and from Dr. Campbell. Even today, this is now six years after seeing the film Forks Over Knives, the 42nd president of the United States eats fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and legumes, and he eschews, he leaves out fats, oils, sugars, and salt. He has become the poster child of the vegetarian movement in America, and everybody's praying for him that he doesn't fall off the wagon because he used to have his weaknesses, right? Because he has become such a powerful image for a healthier lifestyle. And here you have the World Health Organization. It says, the World Health Organization declares processed meat a number one carcinogen in the human diet. Just like smoking causes lung cancer, they say, so meat, processed meat in particular, causes colon cancer. In 1863, that's when it all started, during the great spiritual awakening around the world, a faith community was entrusted with a sacred message of health and reform through a divinely appointed vision. What have we done with it? The health reform principles were laid out by a remarkable God-inspired Battle Creek housewife. They were implemented by a gifted physician and teacher. They were validated at the Battle Creek Sanitarium. We used to be the vanguard. We used to be the leader in this movement. We used to be at the forefront of this whole development. It's now 2018. We find ourselves at another major awakening. It's spreading all over the world. The concept is called lifestyle medicine, where physicians, tired of being the extenders of the pharmaceutical industry, especially young physicians, they're looking for ways to finding the reward for being physicians in seeing patients turning around their diseases and becoming healthy again. These physicians, these lifestyle medicine practitioners, they focus on a very simple diet of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and legumes, and some nuts and seeds. They focus on daily exercise. They focus on being good people, nice people, managing your stress, They focus on taking some time off to reflect on who we are. They recommend stress management. They're basically reflecting the lifestyle that was taught in Battle Creek more than 120 years ago. We received this message by divine revelation beginning in 1863. What have we really done with it? Once again, we are called to lead and to honor God and to bring it forward in its vibrancy, our health heritage, our health message, our sacred trust placed into our hands. Is it not time to honor Him, the God we love, and who entrusted us with a special message of hope, health, and healing to bless others and to validate the concept in our own lives? Is it not time to live out our identity in Him and His concepts? Is it not high time to bring precept and practice together in closer harmony? Is it not time to do what we all know we should be doing? And I close with the opening Bible text that we used. Listen to me, O people of Judah and Jerusalem. Believe in the Lord your God and you will succeed. Believe and remain steadfast to His prophets and you shall prosper. Shall we pray? Our Creator God, who gave the best that you could give your only Son. You gave us the very foods and the lifestyle that we should practice, even validated through your prophet, that we may be epistles to be read by the world and to become pointers towards you. Thank you, Lord, for giving us the health message to open the doors to the hearts of people, so that the love of God can find access to the hearts of people and take roots and to be united with you when you come. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you for being so faithful in coming here. Sometimes it was humid, sometimes it's pelting rain, but you were here and I appreciate that. I am looking forward to now getting on my horse and riding to Columbus next 5-6 hours and to be united with my dear wife. She says, I have something very specially prepared for you because you were not here on Father's Day. It's nice to have this kind of a base at home, isn't it? So I feel very, very blessed, and I was very, very blessed to be invited by your conference president here who has the same feelings that I have, and I really feel that we are looking towards a new day everywhere in North America. Thank you.
I would like to say just one word, two words, three words. In the year 2000, in the year 2000, I had a four-way bypass. How long ago was that? 18 years. And Jane has taught the CHIP program in our church how many times? Twice, three times? And it's because of the messages that you've been hearing and Jane has been sharing that I'm still able to stand 18 years after my heart surgery.
It's true.
Thank you very much.
You have, yeah, in the perfect.